The Berkshire Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Berkshire Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. Would be good if I got the name of the show right. That would be ideal, I think. This evening, I have joining me, Matt is back.
Hello.
Had a bit of a hiatus last week. It's the first show without you, I think.
No, I think I've been off once before.
Oh,
at least.
Yeah. We missed you. Yeah. We missed you all the same.
Vicky covered admirably.
She did. Yeah, she did a good review. If you were listening last week, Vicky sort of filled Matt's place doing a film review, and it was good. We have a new voice in the studio.
Hello.
This is Helen. Helen is our radio brain. I'm going to call you radio brain.
Ooh.
Yeah. Helen has lots of nice radio ideas, and she also loves radio and is good on the radio, so that's why Helen is joining us tonight.
Yeah, happy to be here. Hello.
So coming up on the show, we're going to be talking a lot about Blackshaw's upcoming production of Alice in Wonderland, which opens on Saturday, a week yesterday, if that makes sense. That doesn't make sense.
2nd of May.
Yeah. Next Saturday, Alice is opening. I've been at rehearsals all day, which has been really fun, really chaotic, as, you know, a sort of end-of-the-line rehearsal should be. But, yeah, no, really, really looking forward to Alice going up next Saturday. We've also got a review, which is probably going to happen now.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
All right, Matt, what are you hitting us with this week?
What could I do this week except Avengers Age of Ultron? We're properly into summer blockbuster season now, aren't we?
Oh, yep.
So let me start this by saying that I am a huge fan of superheroes in general, and I've been enjoying most of the superhero movies that have been coming out in recent years. I wouldn't say I'm the world's biggest superhero nerd in any sense, but I do have sort of a deep love that goes beyond criticism for a lot of these movies. So I want you to know that any criticism I have of this movie comes from a good place. It comes from a place of love.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah. So Age of Ultron is you can look at it in one of two ways. It's either about the 12th or 13th in a sequence of Marvel movies. I was trying to count them up before.
Oh my god, there's so many.
There's so many of them. Or you can look at it as the second in a trilogy. It's the second in the Avengers trilogy. So all the other movies that come between them are sort of parts of their own series. They all do feed in. So it's got a huge weight of continuity behind it from all these other movies. And it's also got the middle volume problem to deal with. So middle volumes of books, middle volumes of trilogies always have this problem where they're tying up threads from the previous one. They're setting up things for the third one. They're obviously, of course, when I say second in a trilogy, it's the second in a trilogy in four parts, as all movie trilogies have to be these days. So this will be followed up by Avengers Infinity War Part 1 and Avengers Infinity War Part 2.
Oh, is there two more?
There are two more.
Oh. How can it be Infinity and only two parts?
It's a war about Infinity. I don't think it's a war that takes infinite time.
I think maybe Aisha's quite glad about that, based on what she's just said.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Aisha, the Infinity War stuff is going to be a lot of space.
Oh,
we know by now how you feel about space movies.
Hate space. It's my motto.
So, no space in this one.
Yeah, that's why I kind of liked it.
So I think it works kind of better as, if you consider it as kind of the 12th or 13th movie in a sequence, than if you consider it as the second movie in a trilogy, if that makes any sense. I'll try and make that make some sense. What happens? So this is part of the Marvel sequence. So this is all Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, all of those characters. If you're not familiar with that, those sort of continuities, that's the characters we're dealing with. So the first of these was kind of a lightning in a bottle deal. It was the first time they tied together quite so many characters from so many different films and tried to make them hang together in one movie. And I think everybody was kind of secretly hoping in their hearts that it would work, but there was a lot of doubt that how can you have these sort of six characters, all with their own movies, come in and make a story that makes any sense on the screen. And it did work, and it was incredible. And I think most people's attitude going into this one is, we know by now that they can do it, that the ensemble thing is not a problem for Joss Whedon as the director and wrote the script as well. The ensemble thing is not a problem for him, so the overcrowding thing is not too much of an issue. So the issue now is, can he sort of top what he's done before, or take it successfully to a new place? So what happens in this one is, whereas the first one was more about these sort of lots of different people with different attitudes and different sort of methods and ways of dealing with evil threats coming together and all trying to deal with the same thing, and sort of, can they get on? Can they put aside their differences long enough to make a difference? We start this one in the place where they all get on. We know that they get on. We know that they can work well together. So it's a case of, what threat are they going after now? And actually, the direction that the movie goes is, the question it's asking is, what is our end game? Are we supposed to be? Are we fighting the threats forever? Are we trying to, or are we trying to reach a place where we've made the world safe enough that we are no longer necessary? And sort of that is the thing that then ends up dividing the team. So what happens is, Tony Stark, Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr., is trying to create a sort of world defense network of robots to defend the world from the threats, so that you don't need the Avengers anymore. Effectively, he wants to retire.
Yeah, he just wants to go away and live a nice life in the countryside.
Yeah. And so that sets him up in conflict with some of the other ones, who there is a sense, particularly with Captain America,
that he's Chris Evans' character.
Yeah, which yeah. is that, it does he actually, what would he do with himself if there wasn't a war to be fighting?
I have ideas.
Yeah. Come to my house. he's a great looking guy. Oh,
I know you
goodness.
Told me that how much Chris Evans is there in this film was going to be an issue that came up.
There's enough for me to be able to get through it without getting bored. Let's just say that.
Lovely.
Of course, everything ends up going wrong, and the robots that he ends up creating to defend the world end up wanting to defend the world by destroying it, because you need a threat in a superhero movie. So that leads to the creation of Ultron, played by James Spader, who I think is a less interesting villain than some of the ones we've seen in the Marvel films before. He's certainly less interesting to me than Loki, who was the villain in the first one of these.
But
equally, Loki had been in other films before, so we'd had time to get to know him, whereas Ultron is a one-shot for this movie.
Mm.
So I don't know. He's kind of charismatic, and it's basically what if... a robot was programmed with Tony Stark's personality, except genocidal.
That sounds quite scary. Is it scary?
No.
I found it to be quite scary. I mean, I saw it in... I've never been to Peckinplex before this weekend. £5 for a movie. It's an incredible place, but it means that you're watching a film with about 3,000 other people, including about half of those are children. And a lot of this film, I was a bit like, you know, this is quite... bit of blood, there's a lot of killing going on, you know, some of it's pretty dark. I was like, there's a lot of kids in here.
But equally, Ultron's played quite for laughs, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of his lines are, he's almost insecure as a villain, despite being an ultimate artificial intelligence. So one of the other key differences between this one and the first one is it's a bit more international. They go to unspecified Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They go to South Korea. They go to an unspecified African coast city, which is great to get them out of America, and so that it's not just everybody trying to destroy New York all the time.
Yeah, it's like, go and destroy all the other cities in the world.
Absolutely.
Let's just spread the destruction. Awesome.
Yeah.
Like that.
So it does feel a bit more global, but equally there isn't that kind of commensurate rise in international characters. So there are a couple of Eastern European characters, new superpowered people, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Elizabeth Olsen. So not actually played by Eastern European people. Equally, Andy Serkis is a South African guy, so English person playing South African person. There is a South Korean doctor in it, played by an actual South Korean person, which is Dr. Cho.
Helen Cho, I think.
Dr. Helen Cho, played by Claudia Kim. But for a lot of it, the sort of the international locations feel a bit more like backdrop than anything else. But like I do think it's good for them to be getting out of the States.
Yeah, no, I did enjoy that aspect of the film.
Yeah.
Can I just interject in this review somewhat, Matt? I'm not sure what you feel about this film. I found it so repetitive.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I have criticisms of it. Part of it is you saw it on Peckinplex. I saw it at the BFI IMAX, which is the biggest screen in the country, also in 3D because there wasn't any other option. And I did find I missed a lot of the action. So one of the things that the first Avengers got a lot of praise for was these kind of balletic action sequences that Joss Whedon directed, where it's long tracking shots going all around this city to give this kind of idea of scale of these massive action sequences. And it's got a lot of that again. Well, I feel like I need to see it again to actually catch those, because on such a huge screen and in 3D, it was just a lot of all over the screen that I feel like my eye couldn't really follow a lot of it.
Is that a technical term?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Don't ask me to spell it.
All right.
And the other thing that it's got that the first one didn't, that I think fell a bit flat, was the romance plot line.
Mm.
So it sets up Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff, with Mark Ruffalo's Hulk, Bruce Banner. The Hulk was one of the breakout characters from the first one. Nobody kind of expected him to be as popular as he was. So they've given him a bit more screen time in this one, especially as he hasn't had a film in the meantime of his own. I feel like those two characters kind of bond over how broken each of them is. I didn't feel like there was any sense that they were kind of complementing or completing each other. It was just, I'm broken, you're broken, let's get together. So instead of sort of plucking out the heartstrings, it's kind of it's dueling smallest violins in the world.
It's just getting together for together's sake, really, because who else are they going to, you know, go with? Yeah, I found that to be quite flat in terms of extra storyline. I mean, there's a lot of action going on in this film, and it's just relentless action piece after action piece. And it's because there's been so many of these kind of films, I feel like I go and see one and I'm like, I've seen this before. This was Iron Man.
Yeah.
This was Iron Man 3.
I mean, there's a lot to enjoy in it. There's a lot of good lines. There's a lot of... Mm. Joss Whedon does good sort of funny lines between other... I'm steering away from using the word banter here. Chat between characters during fights and sort of zingy one-liners and that kind of thing. He's quite good at that. There's a few good laughs. He's quite good at physical comedy, which is something that a lot of the grittier, darker superhero movies don't do at all.
Yeah. I think the standout when talking about the comedy aspect of this film is the Thor hammer thing.
Yes.
I mean, that's running through the entire film, as no one can pick up Thor's hammer.
Except Thor,
and, you know, he's a bit sort of like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm the man. It's my hammer. And, yeah, I like that. That's funny. That's funny stuff. But I feel like a lot of the other sort of comedic one-liners are very much like, oh, that's just been put in there just because there's lots of action happening. And
I think ultimately it's a good addition to the sequence, and it sets up enough stuff that it has a useful place in this kind of overall storyline. But as a standalone movie, I think it's a well executed but quite average action blockbuster.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I found it to be quite cringy, to be fair. A lot of the comedy was a bit cringe. I mean, it was just, I was just bored. I was a little bit bored.
Do you have like a superhero movie that you prefer to this one that jumps out to you?
I love Batman. See, I can't get enough of Batman.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of Batman films. I think these films, for me, they try to be quite realistic with, you know, going to Eastern Europe. And I think, you know, going to all those other countries, this film was trying to bring that level of, you know, this could happen in any kind of city, but it couldn't happen, could it? Mm-hmm. Because there is a man who turns into a giant green guy.
I think realism is a really overused term in kind of descriptions of these movies, and especially when the filmmakers themselves are saying what they're going for. Because when they say we're going for realism, what they actually mean is... we're going for something that is internally consistent and makes sense within the rules that we have set up in it.
So it feels authentic rather than real.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be something that could really happen in the real world, but it's supposed to feel like the characters make sense and everything could hang together.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I'm not a big fan of long fight sequences or anything like that. But yeah, balletic is a good description for the first Avengers. So if it's like that in this one, I think I will enjoy it. But yeah, I mean, I really enjoy the Batman films, but equally my favourite of the sort of recent comic book films would be Guardians. So I think potentially, because the Avengers is more on the silly end of the scale, hopefully I will get more out of it than you did.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely leading up to the next one. Yeah. I do understand what you're saying with, like, it is very middle film in terms of you had this amazing stuff happening in the first one, they all got together and it was great and really exciting.
And it was an experiment and it was something that we hadn't really seen work before, so it was exciting.
And it worked really well. And then there's this one, and it's like, no, it's all the same guys. They're doing, you know, fighting stuff again.
Yeah, and there are new characters in it, but they're definitely kind of second string.
Definitely secondary characters, yeah. I don't know. I'm glad I saw it. Yeah. I mean, it's a really enjoyable film. If you want to just go and watch a film that, you know, you don't have to think a load about, then it's great. Go and see it.
And I'll definitely see it again, I think.
I think you probably do need to see it again, because I feel like seeing anything in 3D, you have got no idea about, like, you miss loads of stuff in 3D. I can't stand 3D. I really don't like it. I don't like being made to wear sunglasses inside. It's just weird.
Try doing it when you already wear glasses.
Yeah. I don't know how you... How does that even work?
They make them
Can you get prescription 3D glasses?
Don't make fun of us.
I'm the only way... For those of you listening who can't actually see us, I'm the only one not wearing glasses in this room currently. So I'm making the jokes. Sorry, guys. All right, Matt. Thanks for your review. That was very good. What's have you got plans for next week?
I've been having a quick look. The only one that I can see at the moment is... the name of it temporarily escaped me. I'll update you in a bit. Is the
talk amongst yourselves?
There's one out with Maxine Peake and Maisie Williams off of Game of Thrones,
which is
a period piece, which looks like absolutely completely the opposite of what this week's movie was. A bit more sort of subdued, possibly period. I think it is.
Yeah. I probably won't be seeing that because. Okay. My next in line for, in terms of I hate space, then I hate period dramas.
Okay.
That's why I do not watch that one that Ellie loves,
Downton
Abbey. Yeah, don't watch that. Don't like it. Anyway, moving swiftly on, we are going to go into our Arts Thing of the Week segment tonight. Arts Things, guys, what have we done arts-wise? I know that you saw something last night, Helen.
I went to see Stasis.
Yes.
So that's a play that Encompass Productions have been putting on for the last few weeks. Unfortunately, last night was the final night, but I won't go into too much detail because you can't catch it for the time being. But I would say it was great at the White Bear Theatre, and I thought it was really fascinating. It's sort of sci-fi with a heart, female-led. I think if you liked... maybe Gravity and Interstellar, then this might be your bag, so watch out for it transferring. I thought it sort of puts humans in a unusual situation and pushes them to their limit, all of that sort of, but it's emotional stuff, so I hear that you might have enjoyed it even though it was space.
I touched on it last week because I saw it 2 weeks ago now. And as you know, I don't like space, and this was all set in space, in a spaceship, and it was, in seeing it, it was very claustrophobic. It was quite a claustrophobic play to watch. I really enjoyed it. Wasn't expecting to enjoy it as much as I did, but it was fantastic. And Liam, who directed it, does fantastic work. He's actually going to be working with Blackshaw soon in the sort of upcoming next couple of... Well, you know, towards the end of the year.
That's Liam Fleming.
Liam Fleming.
And the play's by Emily Holyoake.
Yes, that's correct. And they work under... Well, Liam works for Encompass Productions. So unfortunately, it did close last night. But hopefully it will get picked up by something else and then, you know, have another run, which would be really great. So we're going to hear from Vicky, who's not currently in the studio tonight. She's sent us an arts thing, and she's talking about BBC Proms, which I don't really know anything about, but listen to Vicky, and then we'll have a discussion about what's going on with that afterwards.
The BBC Proms, now in its 120th year, is the world's longest-running music festival. This year they're widening the appeal of the traditionally classical music-focused festival, with an increase in matinee performances aimed at families, which has been added to the lineup, and, in a rather exciting twist on the usual, celebrating 20 years of Radio 1 in Ibiza, with Pete Tong hosting prom number 16. The organisers of the Proms' hope is, like so many other areas of the arts, to engage with new and broader audiences. Edward Blakeman, the director of this year's BBC Prom, said to The Guardian, "We do now live in a world, thank God, where you can like all sorts of music. You don't have to be rigidly siloed. When I was a kid, you did have to choose what camp you were in. I was passionate about Dusty Springfield when I was a kid, but you sort of had to do that quietly." Some of the matinees are particularly exciting. David Attenborough will be joining the BBC Concert Orchestra on stage to narrate a prom with music from his series Life Story, which I can only imagine will be absolutely fantastic. And there will be a Sherlock-inspired prom featuring music beloved by the famous fictional detective, well, according to Conan Doyle at least. The 92 Concert Festival kicks off on the 17th of July and runs until the 12th of September. Tickets go on sale on the 16th of May, but you can also buy £5 promming tickets on the day of every single prom that allow you to stand in the centre of the Royal Albert Hall, which makes some of these incredible events really, really affordable. All you need to do is turn up a couple of hours before it starts and queue for a ticket.
So that was Vicky Weston, one of our Blackshaw people, talking to us a little bit about BBC Proms. Now, I don't know anything about this, guys, so I'm hoping that you can help me out a little bit with your ideas about it.
Okay, so I have been to Proms in the Park for the last night of the Proms. The Proms is quite a big British tradition because it's BBC run. So as Vicky's just given us some detail about this year, traditionally it is like a long classical music summer season focused around the Royal Albert Hall. But they also started doing Proms in the Park, so you could sit in a cagoule in the rain and wave a Union Jack while they played Land of Hope and Glory in the Royal Albert Hall.
That sounds interesting.
Which is great if you've had the right amount of pims.
We actually had to look up what Proms... You had an idea, didn't you, Helen, what Proms actually were short for. I had to look it up. So it's Promenade Concerts.
Oh, okay.
The BBC Promenade Concerts.
Mm. So it's been around for a long old time, and then gradually, over recent years, they've been expanding the type of things that they will count as a prom. So it's not just classical music. They've had a Doctor Who prom and a children's prom, and Tim Minchin did a comedy prom a few years ago.
Oh,
so there's
really?
Little
I love
Australian,
him.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
So they're trying to, I think, what Edmund Blakeman was saying is that he's trying to get to the point where there is something for everybody in the proms, rather than people being like, oh, the BBC's spending half the summer on Wimbledon and the other half on the proms.
Have you been to one, Matt?
I've never been to one, no. I've only really caught bits of it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
When you asked what are the proms, explain the proms to me as an Australian person, I was a little bit thrown, to say.
I'm glad it's not just me, then, that's completely oblivious to what this is.
Yeah, so it's a series of classical music concerts, in short. Last night at the Proms, like I say, is really big British tradition. My sister was there right up in the gods of the Royal Albert Hall, and she said the atmosphere was incredible, because it's people that are passionate about all these sort of traditional British pieces of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Proms in the Park, which was really good fun. The people sat in front of us had brought their own plastic fold-out picnic table.
Oh, that's impressive. That's a good setup.
We thought it was pretty good that we had a blanket that was plastic lined. That was pointless in the end, because when the rain is coming down on the top of the blanket, useless for it to be plastic lined.
Yeah.
It's very British preparation.
Yeah. To this day, I still cannot get over how you guys just deal with your summers. But that's another conversation for another time. I think what Vicky was talking about was, from my understanding of BBC Proms is it's always been quite classically based. So lots of classical music. But I feel like what they're trying to do now is broaden it out. And what Vicky was talking about, I think, was they're doing like an Ibiza set, which
wow.
That sounds weird. I've never been to Ibiza, but I'm not sure if that marries up in, well, like, you know, with the BBC and like classical music. Here's a set from Ibiza.
I've been to Ibiza, and yeah, it's some parts of the island are really beautiful and have family orientated resorts, and other bits are really clubby. But I know that Pete Tong is doing a late night prom this year, so they are really expanding the definition of what a prom is. And I think that fits pretty well in terms of how people's tastes are expanding. I think the internet means it's a lot easier to get outside your comfort zone, and that you don't have to pick a particular camp in the way that Blakeman was saying he had to do when he was a kid. Richard Stratton, who wrote Alice in Wonderland, he went to a concert a couple of Friday nights ago that was the London Philharmonic playing the music from Zelda.
Yep.
And he said that half the audience were classical music enthusiasts and half of them were Zelda enthusiasts.
Massive gamers.
So, yeah, I think stuff is sort of, culture clashes are happening more and more. I think
what can't be improved by a massive orchestra behind it? It's like Tim Minchin's concert at the Albert Hall, which I have on CD, was fantastic. John Grant did a set with the Philharmonic Orchestra not long ago on BBC Six. So I can't see Ibiza sets not being improved by the same treatment.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Anything is improved by, you know, 40 strings in the background and some nice, you know, big drum sounds. But no, I think it's interesting. It's an interesting conversation in terms of music tastes. And I definitely agree with you, Helen, in the sense that because of Spotify and the fact that we have so much music at our fingertips on a daily basis, no one is really that scared about telling people what they're listening to anymore. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and you'd only listen to the stuff that was cool. You didn't want to be listening to stuff like Bruce Springsteen when you're 14. Like, that's all I listened to. But I didn't tell anyone that I was listening to that because they'd be like, who's Bruce Springsteen? He sounds old. Yeah, he's old. But I think now our tastes are definitely broadening and everyone's a little less scared to sort of say that you're listening to something weird.
you're not limited to what's in the CD rack at HMV anymore.
No, yeah.
And I think TV and film are helping to broaden the popularity of classical music. So apparently on Classic FM, they're not only playing film soundtracks now. We all know how popular Hans Zimmer is. They're playing music from computer games, which is shocking some of their listeners, but others are loving it. So I think that's great. And I mean, I think this culture clash and, you know, people realizing, okay, so I like this one thing that used to be in that particular genre, but maybe I like more, like with Game of Thrones, some people are like, okay, well, I'm enjoying the TV series, maybe I like this other fantasy novel. And with comic books, comic book films, they're just action films with people in brighter colours.
with capes.
Yeah.
Except in the Batman ones.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And then that's making people think, okay, well, maybe I'm interested in other graphic novels or, you know. So I think that people's tastes are broadening, but equally I can see that maybe this is the BBC trying to make sure they can keep hold of the proms that they're proud of by making it appeal to more of their audience.
I mean, the BBC is always, I feel that they're always trying to broaden their audience and get up to speed with, you know, the cool things that the kids are doing, and, you know, their online media presence is, you know, getting more innovative, I think. And
they're actually they want to be digital first or internet first in the next few years. I know BBC Three is going online only.
We're doing the company that I work for are doing quite a big push with the BBC at the moment in terms of like their online presence and stuff. So, like, you know, they're actively trying to get more involved with what's going on online, which is nice. And I feel like, you know, this season of the proms is them being like, hey guys, we're cool. And I mean, and listen to us.
And the proms get bigger every year. Like, there are more of them. There's more music, more runtime. So it's not like they're leaving anything out in order to make room, or not leaving much out in order to make room for the new things that are coming in. The proms are just getting larger.
Yeah, they're really into expansion, I think, the BBC. They want to own all the things. We want to have all the people listening to us and, you know, doing that. I suppose that's good on them. I think it's good.
Sorry. Because we all pay for it, I think they their remit has to be as broad as possible. They try and make it so there's something for everyone, which is very difficult to do.
Yeah, hugely.
But I like the experimental idea of an Ibiza prom. I will be catching that.
Yes, no, I'm very interested as well. So that's all for arts thing. There'll be another arts thing next week. I spoke a little bit before about how I was at an Alice rehearsal today, and Alice opens on Saturday. We're going to get you sort of in the mood of Alice with this poem. It's The Walrus and the Carpenter.
The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright, and this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be, the sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead, there were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it surely would be grand. If seven maids with seven mops swept for half a year, do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. Oh, oysters, come and walk with us, the walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, pleasant talk along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than four to give a hand to each. The eldest oyster looked at him, but never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But four young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat. And this was odd because, you know, they hadn't any feet. Four other oysters followed them, and yet another four, and thick and fast, and they came at last, and more, and more, and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock, conveniently low, and all the little oysters stood and waited in a row.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes, ships, and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings.
But wait a bit, the oysters cried, before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat.
No hurry, said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that.
A loaf of bread, the walrus said, is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar, besides, are very good indeed. Now, if you're ready, oysters dear, we can begin to feed.
But not on us, the oysters cried, turning a little blue. After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do.
The night is fine, the walrus said. Do you enjoy the view? It was so kind of you to come, and you were very nice.
The carpenter said nothing but, cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice.
It seems a shame, the walrus said, to play them such a trick, after we've brought them out so far and made them trot so quick.
The carpenter said nothing but, the butter's spread too thick.
I weep for you, the walrus said. I deeply sympathize.
With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes.
Oh, oysters, said the carpenter, you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again? But answer came there none, and this was scarcely odd because they'd eaten every one.
That was The Walrus and the Carpenter, which features in our upcoming production of Alice in Wonderland somewhat. We're trying to sort of get us in the groove of Alice tonight because it's opening on Saturday and we're all very excited.
So that was written by Lewis Carroll, read by Alexander Pankhurst, who's in the show.
That is correct, yes. We're using a lot of our actors to do a lot of things for us on the show. I was at rehearsals today and I stole our set and costume designer, Zara, away and did an interview with her. This interview was conducted in the Beer Garden of the Selkirk, which is not where Alice in Wonderland is happening. We use that space to rehearse. It is where the first run of the play happened. This run coming up and starting on Saturday is taking place at the Battersea Library, very close to Clapham Junction, very close to where we are now, actually. So yeah, I stole Zara. We sat in the beer garden. Zara was busy making half of the set as we did this interview. And she speaks to us a little bit about her role in Alice in Wonderland and her sort of creative process in terms of being a set designer and costume designer. So here it is. In Blackshaw's upcoming production of Alice in Wonderland, I am talking to Zara Mansouri, who is set designer and costume designer, and she's working with her associate designer, Michelle Bristow. So let's start off with just sort of run us through what your job is for this current production of Alice in Wonderland.
So I've been designing the costumes and set based on the sort of the show that we did last year, and this was in collaboration with Ellie and Michelle, who's been executing the design. So essentially I've sort of taken what we did and adapted it and sort of reimagined it, because it's a very different context which we're playing with at the moment. So it was still using the same characters and the same ideas of how the original set worked and how the original costumes worked for each character, but putting it in the context of the site-specific venue of the library, just to make sure that the design's all sort of was coherent with the space.
So the space that we're in this time for this run is bigger than the last time. So how have your designs changed in terms of working with a new space?
In terms of costume, whenever there's... obviously, last time it was a very intimate space, so the detail was on a sort of micro level. But now that the space is completely blown apart, bigger, essentially. we've sort of taken maybe, like, for example, the Queen of Hearts had a much smaller skirt and little details on her crown, whereas this time, just so that you can just see her coming, she's got a bigger skirt, and we've just, yeah, made everything bigger and brighter. So, like, the Mad Hatter last year had a black jacket, and he's now wearing red, just so that it's a bit more sympathetic to the fact that we need macro detail within the library.
Is this your first Blackshaw production that you've worked on? What other stuff have you done with this theatre company?
This is not my first time. I broke my virginity with Blackshaw about 5 years ago, when I found out they were doing a production of Gormenghast, which was one of my favourite books, and indeed the BBC series, which was absolutely amazing in terms of design and concept and characters. So I sought them out. I found out where they were doing the read-through. I hunted them down. I flirted my arse off with Ellie Pitkin, and then had a chance chat with Strat, who wrote this one, actually, as I queued for the loos, and sort of got very engaging and was like, so, have you got a designer yet? So hunted them down, and now Ellie just can't get rid of me. I love working with the company. So after that, I did Ghost Finder. I also, there's others. My memory's shot to pieces. It's a Sunday afternoon. But I've done about four or five years off and on.
So you're pretty busy at the moment doing other things. So we've brought you in to work on Alice, but like we said before, you've got an associate designer.
Yes.
How does that mean that do you work differently in that sense?
I work differently in the sense that I'm like, you trust, you an associate is a bit like finding a very good wife, boyfriend, husband, whatever you prefer. So once you find someone that you trust, essentially an associate, if I was to get knocked over by a car and I handed over the file of design knowledge, they would pick it up and be able to execute it. So in this sense, whilst I've been working with another company, I did almost like a blueprint, where we had meetings initially back in February, saw the venue and talked about what we needed to do this time round. And then I redesigned it, and essentially this time round I'd done the process how I normally would, but the execution of it has been a lot more via email. I haven't been able to attend some of the fittings, and my associate's been able, Michelle, has been able to feed back to me what needs doing, so that the days that I can do here, I'm able to turn up and just do those things, because my brain space is somewhat jam-packed. But it's been a delight, and she's been amazing in terms of making this an enjoyable process.
What other things are you've mentioned that you're working quite hard at the moment? What else is happening in the life of a costume and set designer for you?
Well, at the moment, I'm working with repertory training company Fourth Monkey Theatre, and they tend to open. They like to make an impact, and a lot of it is ensemble based, so big casts, lots of different venues, and they open seasons of plays. So I won't just be opening one play a month. I have seen up three. I've seen up five plays already since January, which was Tamburlaine and a Shakespeare comedy season, which I did the Get Out for last night, hence the waffling, rambling, and forgive me if I do start not making sentences, that's probably why. And I've just in the past 2 weeks started designing their next two seasons, which is going to be opening at the end of the month. And those plays are The Public by Lorca and Don Juan Comes Back from the War. And we're also doing a devised piece, which is very exciting, with the theatre company Told by an Idiot. So that's been super cool, which is going to be a steampunk-esque pirate show. And I'm trying not to regurgitate the wonderful work of Lizzie Clacken, who's just they've just closed Treasure Island. But it's that sense and scale of people. So, yes.
Very busy.
Very busy. 30 actors to dress for three plays with two looks each. That's about 500 items of costume to either source, make, adapt over the next 2 weeks when the fittings are.
That is intense.
Oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead. Life's too short.
I love that saying. So talk us through, in terms of doing something on such a large scale like that, and even scaling down to something, you know, that's kind of smaller, like Alice, where do you begin with creative process? Like, where do you even start with that?
The creative process, I suppose it's a mix of things, and it varies depending on what the piece is, but the start is always the text. It's very important. I don't like, I'm not an interior designer. I never like designing things for the sake of having them on stage. So I try, in my work, I'm always true to the text. So always starts with the script. And then from there, it depends also on what direction your director wants to take it in. So when I'm reading a script, how the feel and the essence of the story that the director wants to tell is always quintessential in the work that I do. So then I'll marry whatever the period that they would like to do with the context of the play. And so, for example, Don Juan Comes Back from the War is very much, well, it's set after the First World War, so it's important that we keep that context. But the direction the director's taking is that she wants the stories of the women, if you're not familiar. He encounters different women after the war, and they're all sort of mourning the loss of what happened in World War One. So it's quite poignant. We're going to have all the women in mourning. So I've been researching, and it's set in Berlin, so the country figures out what period I'm going to address. And so that's sort of it from a costume point of view. But then set, she wants it to be a bit more conceptual. So the like German expressionist lines, which were very poignant at the time in terms of design to help aid the story. So then you marry the text with these things and you get a design.
Very, very good explanation. I'd like to ask you, what's your dream in terms of creating set costume?
The dream? Well, I've been working in fringe theatre now since I graduated for 6 years, and I'm getting to the point now where I wouldn't mind sort of starting breaking into the bigger theatres, and to do that I realise I need to take a step down to take a step up. So I would like to start assisting designers and learning more, because I've never put a revolve on stage. To reference Miss Clacken again, who's a absolutely stunning designer who, like, since her days with Shunt, just trying to figure out how you take those small things and blow them out of proportion so that when I'm ready for, hopefully, one day my first job at the National, I know how to play with those toys too, because my dream design was actually a piece that I did, second year piece I did at uni, which was a speculative project. And it was Mother Clap's Molly House. And to be able to, and I can imagine if I were to create that design, I would need to learn a lot more about hydraulics and revolves. So the dream is, and in the long and short of it, is I'd love to one day be doing really punchy, vital work that they like, the likes that they produce at the National, and be able to tell stories.
That was an interview that I did with Zara, the costume and set designer of Alice in Wonderland, our upcoming production.
Hashtag Alice 150.
Yes, 150th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And it's married up quite well with us putting the production on this year, I think.
Almost like it was planned.
We didn't plan it. We don't plan anything. We're not a planning company. We don't do that. You don't need to plan things. It's fine.
Is that the official company position?
No. I'm going to say no. I don't think we'd be 5 years in the making if there was no planning involved. If I was at the helm of Blackshaw, it would be a nightmare. Just going to put that out there. That's why Ellie does such a fantastic job, because she's so much more organized than I am. So that was Zara talking to us, which was quite interesting for me, because I mean, we talk a lot about theatre on this show, and we interview writers and, you know, actors, and we talk about the writing process and the acting process, but you don't really think about what it takes to be the person who's designing an entire world. And Alice in Wonderland is the kind of play that you need to be completely consumed in. The writing's fantastic, the acting's fantastic, but it is really, it's up there in terms of a, you know, really, really great, fantastic adaptation because of the set and because of the way it looks, because you feel like you're completely immersed in it.
It's one of those roles that the designer and to an even greater extent, I think, the sound designers and lighting designers that are constantly overlooked in reviews. So yeah. It's good to be putting somebody like that on the air.
Yeah, and it's great to hear about that creative process. And talking to Zara, I mean, she's done this her entire life. And we were talking about how it's so fantastic doing something that you love. And, you know, I was talking to her and she was busy making stuff as we were, you know, doing an interview, because she just cannot get enough of it. And that's the kind of person that you want working on a production, who will just put so much of their time in. And Zara is one of the busiest people I know. And, you know, she's completely redesigned this entire production. She's, really fantastic.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to her convincing us that we're no longer in the library, but that we are in Wonderland. That should be really exciting. I completely trust her with that, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be a really, really great production. We'll talk a little bit more about getting tickets and, you know, running times and all that a little bit later in the show. If you want to tweet us, I've forgotten to tell you that we're on Twitter. We are on Twitter. You hear it every week, but we are at Blackshaw Update. If you want to send us a tweet and talk to us, we're here. We like talking.
And you might want to join, as I said, hashtag Alice150 to talk about the 150th anniversary of Alice in Wonderland, or hashtag WAFChat.
WAFChat.
To talk about the Wandsworth Arts Fringe, yes, which Alice is a part of.
It's a massive tongue twister, that one.
Ellie's been tweeting from the marathon rehearsal today that the Alice cast have all been in, and she put up a lovely photograph of the cast just before their first dress run, so you can get a little sneaky peek of some of the costume there.
Yeah.
Marathon rehearsal, I like what you did there.
Oh, credit to Alex Pankhurst for that, I think. I don't think that was me.
So current. We're so topical.
Yeah.
Yeah, we like to be topical. Anyway, moving on. We're going to play some poetry right now. This is a poem that is untitled, by one of our favourite poets who's worked quite a bit with Blackshaw. Her name is Daisy Thurston Gent. I know that Helen is a massive fan of Daisy's poetry.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Got a little bit of a crush on Daisy.
Yeah, yeah. I just love how emotionally honest but lyrical she is. It's quite difficult to balance those two things. And she's excellent to see live. You know, look up some poetry slams or whatever. You can get some exciting live experiences with, you know, all poets. And yeah, Daisy's excellent though. So I'm looking forward to hearing this poem because I don't know if I've heard it before. Yeah, I know that you played her one about the ocean a few weeks ago, and I was sort of a bit emotional in my kitchen making meatballs. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
This is not the one about the ocean. This is an untitled poem by Daisy Thurston Ghent.
In the mornings, I cry behind my eyes, and I blame it on the drinking. I can't relax, my bones crack, and it's got me thinking if this is it forever, right? Whatever that means. If by the end we're just two seams splitting and you're leaving me, I know it. Slowly. Each day closer to the day you go away or I do, whichever way round it is, we're tearing apart. But apart from that, we're good. Apart from the fact that I still think about running away daily just to save me the hassle of sewing myself up when we split. One stitch in time saves no one. I've come to realise. And I despise every piece of advice that my mother gave me that I hated that turned out to be right. I hated the fights that made nights memorable. I hated the stairs for a while. Even though I never fell down them, just frowned when I heard sentences I didn't get yet from the top sitting down on them, listening, christening the banisters in my tears. These days I save them, pretend I don't give a crap, like I've grown out of that, but now I weep at poetry. And I feel I should offer an explanation. I think apologies are needed for my behaviour. I fear forgiveness is in order, but I just can't give it yet. I'm still caught up in my bad habits, and yeah, I do hold grudges, and I hold them deep in fury, and surely you can see why. Nobody knows that I hold my rage close to my bones. I hold my rage close to my bones. And I can cry by the way that Tom Waits reads the first line of America, and I'm not sure if I'm crying at Ginsberg's words or the weight of the weights. And I'm under the impression that very few boys want to be with a girl who speaks at least two octaves lower than most of the girls she meets, or writes for herself, or speaks in beats, because that means she thinks. I try so hard to think about what I say, I forget to craft the way I'm saying it, and when playing it back I think, do I sound like that? So maybe you will cackle and snigger, but believe me, I did first and my laugh's bigger. But I have a thirst for speaking and for writing, but it's speech that's beating me to the page, so I just open my mouth and say it. Anyway, I often say the wrong thing. The wrong lines come easy when I don't take the time to construct them properly, when I become lazy and let my tongue roll out like a red carpet for the untalented layabouts and label it speaking freely. It's easy to sound it out, but meaning it is different, isn't it? I shouldn't have to make my voice sound like a girl's just so you like me, so you take the time out of your life to talk back to me. Here's a lesson. You accept the imperfections, not reject them. Embrace their methods of affection and perfect them. Hear the words they're trying to say and connect them. Don't correct them. Try your hardest to collect their faults and triumphs. You'll need them for your collection when you try your best to section out why you love them so much in parts over the rest of them. Learn to love them and stop testing them. Push the hate aside that's pestering and festering and accept them. See the best in them. Don't make them ever feel lesser than they are. Don't plonk them on a pedestal like in songs you listen to. Find a real place for them. Hide them in your heart. Because it's the only organ we know to be strong enough to keep things from dying. The brain's trying, but it's not quite there yet. It's just a network of cells that sometimes still forgets. Nah, the heart's the best bet. It will pump until it stops, unlike the brain, which deteriorates, tangling knots of facts and imaginings until it's too blurry to focus on reality. People are real. Stop trying to conceal your feelings. We're not mind readers or big believing social healers reading from tea leaves that you spat back into a cup. We can do this. You and me. Beat the organs that define how we need to beat to be. Don't let us become blurry. Don't forget me. Don't forget. Don't.
That was a poem, an untitled poem, by Daisy Thurston Ghent, one of the people that works a little bit with Blackshaw. She's done a lot of new writing nights and stuff for us, and she's a fantastic poet.
You can find her on Twitter at DaisyTGPoetry.
Yes, she's all over Twitter, like we are, because we're at Blackshaw Update on Twitter, if you want to tweet us. We are nearly at the end of the show this evening. We're going to talk a little bit about how you can go and see Alice in Wonderland, which opens on Saturday at the Battersea Library in Clapham Junction. The dates are from Saturday, which is the 2nd,
yep,
all the way till the 17th of April. So we're running for 2 weeks. We've got a show a night, two shows on Saturday, I believe. And it's a part of WAF, which is the Wandsworth Arts Fringe Festival. I think that's correct.
It's just Wandsworth Arts Fringe this year, I think.
Yeah, it's not a festival. I don't know how we've lost the festival aspect of it, but never mind. So yeah, any kind of Wandsworth Arts Fringe talk is hashtag WAF chat on the Twitter.
Yeah.
There's lots of things happening.
So just on the dates, there are a few dates in that period that it's not on, and there are some days where it's on twice, where there's a matinee and an evening. So I think the best way for people to find out exactly when it's on is at Blackshaw's website, which is
blackshawonline.com.
Yep. All links to tickets are on there. We're also on Facebook. We're all over Twitter. We're all over the social media. So jump on and grab a ticket. It's £6 for adults, £3 for children. And it's going to be a great show. I'm so excited. I'm so excited because I've seen actual costumes and I've seen actual makeup happen today. And it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, the script's got a lot of charm and it's an hour long. And it's not too intense for little ones. Suitable for children of all ages,
I would
say. It's
also got, you know, adult jokes thrown in, so...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed it last year. Really excited for this year.
Yeah. So that's all we have time for on the show. We're going to be here next week as well doing a special Alice show. It's going to be WAF orientated, lots of fringe talk, lots of festival talk, lots of Alice reviews, hopefully. We'll be here from six till seven. And this has been the Blackshaw Arts Hour. Thank you, Matt, and thank you, Helen, for joining me in the studio this evening.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to leave you tonight with our beautifully produced Alice in Wonderland trailer.
Tell us a story, girl. Tell us a tale. The hare doesn't have much of one, and the queen chopped the mouses off.
Oh, the queen! The queen! Where is she? Where is she?
Now look what you've done.
Alice!
How doth the little crocodile improve its shining tail?
Alice!
And pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale.
We're all mad here.
How cheerfully it seems to grin.
I'm mad.
How neatly spreads its claws.
They're mad.
And welcomes little fishes in.
You're mad.
With gently smiling jaws.
Alice!
Stop laughing, that wasn't funny.
I thought it was, but then I find most things funny.
Fall down the rabbit hole with Alice as her world is turned upside down in this new adaptation of Lewis Carroll's classic Alice in Wonderland. Suitable for ages 4 and up and plenty of jokes for the grown-ups, adapted by Richard Stratton and produced by Blackshaw Theatre Company. On at Battersea Library from the 2nd to the 16th of May. Tickets are £6 for adults and £3 for children. Available now at blackshawonline.com.
That is the silliest thing I've ever heard, and I won't believe it.